Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Steve, I'm an alcoholic. Doing this workshop for you this morning is Don Major from Louisville, Kentucky, and I will turn this over to him. Give him a warm round of applause.
Thank you, Steve, and good morning, everybody. My name is Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm real grateful to be here. I hope it's okay with you guys for me to be sitting down and doing this. It could be all laziness because I'm that lazy, but it turns out this morning it's not. I've had some real serious knee problems this past week, so I thought it'd be better if I didn't stand up for a couple of hours. So thank you, folks, for having me in your beautiful part of the world. I've been blessed with being out this way a few times. I've never been to Astoria before, but it's a beautiful part of the world, and the AA Fellowship out here just has a beautiful spirit. So thank you so much for letting me be part of it. And if you don't mind, could we start off with the Serenity Prayer, please? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Thank you, guys. And, you know, the first question that always comes to my mind when I do something like this is, who do I think I am to be sitting up here going to talk to you folks about the steps? I guess I know more about what I'm not. I'm certainly not a teacher. As we all know, there are no teachers in AA. Over the years, I've known some folks that seem like they maybe had a restless urge to teach. I don't know that I've ever wanted a whole lot of what it looked like to me they had. The reason I'm here is real simple. Somebody asked me. I've never once sent out flyers saying, your program in your area probably needs a spiritual boost. Why don't you let me come and share my magnificence with you, and I'm sure it'll help you a lot. So when I was a couple of months sober, I went to my sponsor because I was very concerned. I was sure my story, you know, with the movie rights to it and all that sort of thing that would be involved, I was sure the world was going to beat my door down, wanting to hear from me. Of course, nobody asked me to talk for about 2 years, but at 60 days sober, I didn't know that. So I went to my sponsor in a quandary about how I was going to know what to accept and what to turn down. And he said, Don, you usually ask off-the-wall questions that I have to give you some sort of vague answer to or tell you to pray about it or whatever. He said, but you have finally asked a question that I can answer specifically. He said, you won't have any trouble knowing what you're supposed to do and not do in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when you're supposed to do something, somebody will ask you. And I've tried my best to live by that. If I'm asked to do something Alcoholics Anonymous and I can do it, I really try to do it. The first time I was ever asked to do this a number of years ago, it kind of threw me off because by that time I was, you know, really accustomed to telling my story. And I could do that without a whole lot of problem. I don't know that you ever get to the point where you don't have some nervousness about talking about yourself in front of a bunch of people. But I tell you what does help, though. When you finally figure out that God is not about to trust you with the welfare of a room full of people. You know, when you finally figure out that if you get up there and make the biggest ass on earth out of yourself, it will be just exactly what somebody needs to help them on their spiritual journey. So there's no way I can mess this up. God won't let that happen. But first time I was asked to do something like this, you know, do the steps, I didn't know what to do, and it occurred to me the only thing that I've got to share is what has worked for me and the same thing that I've told sponsees one-on-one over the years. So that's all in the world I've got to tell you is basically what worked for me, and in turn I've turned around and shared with sponsees one-on-one. Want to tell you that I don't read a lot of outside literature, you know, self-help things and that sort of thing. And I really do not want to be controversial, and I mean that. One of the most helpful things in this book to me is where it says we would like nothing so much as to write a volume that didn't stir any controversy. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a rule for me. I don't want to be controversial. If you look at the book, the first 164 pages, for instance, Bill never calls alcoholism a disease. Did Bill believe alcoholism was a disease? Surely. But in the 1930s, it was far more controversial than it is today about whether alcoholism was a disease. But instead of taking a stand and, by George, I'm going to make my point, Bill realized that he could communicate everything he needed to communicate by calling alcoholism a malady, an illness, a disorder, and not ever using a word that would stir controversy and perhaps turn some people off from ever getting the message that's in this book. So it's never called a disease in the first 164 pages for that reason. And I don't want to stir controversy, but I do not read a lot of outside material. And I don't condemn, you know, if my sponsees want to do that, I tell them fine. Occasionally I'll get one that gets a little out of line. My dear friend, and actually he's been sober a few months longer than I have, and I've been his sponsor for years, has got a tendency to go a wee bit overboard. Harlan, it's Billy that you met with me when we did the thing for the lawyers up in the state. But Billy got into, and he knows I tell this, I have full permission. He got into being non-materialistic. So the first month that he was into that, he spent $1,800 on books how not to be materialistic. So occasionally I'll mention to somebody that they may be standing on a whale's back fishing for minnows. And I believe that with all my heart. What I've found is that this big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of recovery, that's the steps and nothing else according to the book, and that's the way it's worked for me, plugs us into all the power in the universe. And why I would want to go to some other source when I haven't fully explored what's available to me through doing these steps and using them in my life is beyond me. But what I'm getting to there is, although I've never read the book because I don't read much of that, there's a book that's been around for a few years that I love the title of, and that's The Spirituality of Imperfection. Because I want to tell you something. Thank God that this is a perfect program for imperfect people. I'm going to share some things with you that I know work very, very well in my life when I do them. Now, I also will tell you going in that I have some insane tendencies. If something works too well, I'm apt to quit. You know, if it just works so terribly, terribly well, I'm apt to just quit. Well, I don't need it anymore. It's working too well. So I'll tell you about a lot of things that don't work when I stop working them too. So I just want you to know that what my spiritual progress has been, and for those of you that hear my story tonight, and I don't want to get into my story much today, but you'll hear that I got here closed completely to spiritual things. I almost died because the mention of God and you guys trying to soft soap it by calling it higher power made me madder than ever. I knew what you were talking about. Kept running me out of here. So man was an acting as if deal. That's how I got here. That was my second step, was becoming willing to act as if I believed there was a power greater than myself. And I want to tell you that it's worked beautifully over the years. But when I began to have a spiritual awakening, and that term has never been mysterious to me, you know, what is a spiritual awakening? To me, it's literally what it says. Because I was comatose to spiritual things. I was not conscious to them. I was asleep to spiritual things. And it was, as a result of these steps, what's happened to me is that most of the time now I am awake. I am aware of spiritual things. Doesn't mean that I have become a spiritual giant. Doesn't mean I do the right thing all the time. What it does mean is I'm no longer comatose to spiritual things. But when I began to come to believe, I had sort of an idea that spiritual progress was going to be an unbroken progression, you know, maybe slowly, but basically an unbroken progression upward. Let me tell you what it's been. And sometimes right today, and by the grace of God, my sobriety date is April 9th, 1981. So sometimes right today at 24 years sober, sometimes I have to go through what I'm getting ready to share with you 100 times. What will happen to me is that I'll stumble a couple steps in the right direction. And somewhere along the line, I will temporarily forget that I ever did a third step. When I say forget, it's just nowhere in my consciousness. I'll forget that I ever did a seventh step. I'll forget that there's any such thing as an 11th step to live on. And what happens is that I get knocked in the dust by self-will. I mean, that's a spiritual law. When I forget that and I start coming from self, I'm going to wind up knocked in the dirt. And what God has given me the great gift of being able to do is get up and dust myself off and say, oops, Mom, Dad, I'm sorry, excuse me, please, and stumble another couple of steps in the right direction and then get knocked over again. So say some days I have to start over 50 to 100 times. And I thought every time that happened, that was an interruption of my spiritual growth. But what I've come to know for me is that that process is the only spiritual growth of which I'm capable. And it turns out that my God doesn't require perfection from me. He or she doesn't even really require consistency. My God seems to be tickled to death with persistence, just getting up and stumbling in the right direction. So some of the things that I'll be talking about this morning that have worked so well for me, during the time that I was working up to the point where I got such wonderful results from it, I would be thinking, oh, I'm doing this too poorly. I'm not doing this well enough, beating up myself, thinking it wouldn't work. But I know now that there is no limit to my God's forgiveness. And I know now that something does not have to feel like it's working in the process of me doing it for it to work. And if I ever pick up a drink and die from a mad dog death, and I'm convinced that if I pick up a drink, I will die a mad dog death, and I know I truly don't know whether I'll die drunk or sober. And I used to hear old folks that had been sober 20 or 25 years, like me now, when I was young in the program, I used to hear them say, well, I'm just a drink away from a drunk. Everybody's here just a day at a time. And I'd think, oh, give me a break. You know, I can't possibly imagine that you would ever drink again. My God, you've been dry so long, you're a fire hazard. And I know now that those old guys were telling it like it is. I truly don't know whether I'll die drunk or sober. But what I do know, I believe, is that if I pick up a drink again, the thing that will make me pick it up is that part of me that tells me that I've fouled up so badly there's no use. And that part of me is alive and well every day of my life, talking to me on every level of my life, at work, in personal relationships, in the program, telling me, you've fouled up so bad that you're so far off God's will that there's no longer a next right thing to do. Let me tell you something. There's a next right thing to do in the middle of robbing a bank. There's always a next right thing to do. I can't get outside my God's forgiveness. I can't get to the point where that little spark of the divine in me won't tell me where to take the next stitch if I listen. My trouble, of course, is I won't try to figure out the pattern so I'll know where to start stitching. I've got about as much shot of figuring out the patterns in my life as a chimpanzee does mastering quantum physics. I'm 61 years old, and I've never seen one significant pattern in my life correctly. And yet I won't sit back and try to figure it out, and that's not my job. I'm playing God when I'm trying to figure out the pattern. My job's stitching, when I'll just listen and take that little stitch in the next right place. And, you know, the enemy of doing that next right thing, when I first began to become awake to spiritual things, I thought it would be things like greed and lust. And it is, maybe 1% of the time. 99% of the time, it's fear. It's fear that it won't work out right, that the pattern's not going to be right if I take that stitch where my heart knows that next right thing tells me to take it. And my faith isn't a nice warm feeling that God's got me in the palm of God's hands. That's the reward for faith. Faith is taking that next stitch where I know it needs to be taken, when my brain's all spinning and telling me, oh, it's going to be a mess. It won't work out if you don't lie here. It won't work out if you don't fudge here. My faith is that scary thing with my palm sweating, taking that stitch at that next right place, and that nice warm feeling that God's got everything under control and I'm okay. That's the reward for faith. But anyway, I kind of got off on that to let you know how, or try to let you know how terribly imperfect I am. And this morning, I believe this with all my heart, I don't believe that any of us will learn anything that will help us at all. Because I believe that this is only the tiniest little bit of a learning process. I believe this is a doing process. If I cannot tell you why the things we're going to talk about this morning work, and you know what? I no longer care why they work. I no longer care about the mechanics or whatever mechanics may be involved there. I know I don't understand. I don't know why. Getting on my knees every morning and every night since April of 1981 has let me not drink a day at a time for all these years. I have no idea. There's no logical connection between those two things. But I know absolutely that that has been a huge factor in my not drinking a day at a time for all those years. So I'm not going to try to share any of my intellectual enlightenment with you, because if I do, I might kill both of us. I want to share with you what we've done. I don't believe, for me, again, no controversy. I don't want to get controversial. If somebody, and I've got a lot of step things just like this that tapers have labeled step study that are floating around out there, and that's fine. I'm not going to get on any soapbox and say, now, wait a minute, I don't want it labeled step study. I don't like, for me, the label of step study, because a couple of reasons. Number one, most alcoholics are so lazy that the idea of studying something will run them the other way anyway. I know I am. And the second thing is, it implies that somehow if we learn all this stuff, it's going to make us better. And I want to tell you, I learned early in sobriety that knowledge without action is not useless. It's worse than useless. Because once I know what to do and I'm not doing it, I'm a whole bunch worse off than I was before I even knew what to do. So I like to call this a step use discussion. So you call it whatever you want to. I'm going to call it step use discussion. And what we're doing through these steps is what the book says. We're trying to get some divine intervention. Now, I got a buddy over in Minneapolis, Bob B. And Bob says that farmers don't grow anything. Farmers create an environment in which growth can take place, and God grows things. And doctors don't heal anybody. Doctors try to create an environment in which healing can take place, and God heals. And I believe that's exactly the way these steps work. This is not a psychological process, folks. It's the farthest thing in the world from a psychological process. It's a spiritual process. To me, the main thing is coming to it as a little child and being willing to follow directions, even though I do not understand and cannot see how following those specific directions are going to solve my unique problems. Because, you know, if there's one flag that we would all salute, the flag is the one that says, my case is different. So I believe that with all my heart. Big Book may or may not be the only way. It's the only way I've ever found that works, and it's all that I know to talk about. I think it would be as contrary to the principle and the tone of this book as it could possibly be to say, well, if you're an alcoholic, this is the only way you have to live. I don't think that's the way the book teaches me that it is. For me, it is the only way. And it's absolutely the only way, that only thing that I've got to share with you guys this morning that that I hope can be helpful. Sometimes in talking about the steps and telling my story, I talk so much about action. In fact, I get quoted back to me a lot that it doesn't make any difference what you think, feel, or believe, that your life is going to be determined by what you do. What you think, feel, and believe will never go in the record book. And I don't know that I ever originally said it just exactly like that, but I'll take it. But when I say that, I'm not saying stuff your feelings. These 12 steps, in fact, have wound up being the most effective vehicle I've ever found in my life to identify my feelings, look them straight in the eye, and say, yes, there they are. What I am saying is that for 37 years of my life, that's how old it was when I got sober, I built a shrine to my feelings. You see, without divine intervention, how I feel has always been, and without divine intervention remains today, the most important thing in the world to me. Without divine intervention, how I feel is the most important thing in the world to me. And up until I got sober, when I had a feeling, it was an automatic process, not requiring any thought. All of my actions fell in behind my feeling, and I went to work on you to get you to fall in behind my feeling too. It was just the absolute center of the universe. So I'm not saying stuff them. I'm just saying let's give a little thought to the fact that maybe the way we feel is not the most important thing in the universe. Give you a good example of that. Because what my illness is at its core is simple, and I'll talk about this tonight, where the book says that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. What that means to me is the first thing wrong with me is I've got an ego disorder. I've had an ego disorder all my life. And because of that ego disorder, without divine intervention, I am so obsessed with me, and I'm so obsessed with how I feel, and I'm so obsessed with how I stack up against the rest of the world, that it creates so much pain and so much emptiness down inside me that I simply cannot stand it. And that is the root of my alcoholism. That's the root of my troubles, that when I'm into that and without divine intervention, I'll do anything to try to fill up that emptiness and do something about that pain that obsession with myself has created down inside me. I'm going to move on for that a minute and talk about a couple of other things before we start in specifically on the steps. I want to talk about the steps in general. I believe that they are the only program of recovery for the simple reason that that's what the book says. The part that we read and call How It Works before meeting starts says here are the steps we took that are suggested as a program of recovery. In early sobriety, I was challenged to find anything else in the first 164 pages of the book that were called a program of recovery. And I'll save you the trouble, no need in looking, it's not there. Nothing is called a program of recovery except those 12 steps. What that means to me is that I can latch onto this fellowship and I can be a member of the fellowship on any day I've got a desire to stop drinking. Thank God there's no more requirement than that. And I can latch onto this fellowship like a leech without doing these steps, and I might stay dry for a week, or I might stay dry for 30 years. But if I do that, I'll have absolutely no healing of what's really wrong, of that disordered ego, of that, you know, letting how I feel be the most important thing in the universe, except just exactly as I do these steps the way the book tells me to do them. My original sponsor, who was Cherry, C-H-E-R-R-Y, Carpenter from Nashville, Tennessee. Cherry used to say that his wife was the only woman who still had her Cherry after being married 40 years. well, it's kind of gross, but Cherry said that all the time. Cherry used to fuss at me gently when I would refer to myself as a recovering alcoholic. What he'd say, Don, if you want to refer to yourself as a recovering alcoholic, that's fine, but be aware that that's a treatment center term. Be aware that the big book refers to us as recovered alcoholics. So I said, well, Cherry, where have they hidden that in the big book? And Cherry pointed out to me that the first place they hid it was in the subtitle of the book. I didn't even know the book had a subtitle. But the subtitle of the book is the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And then he said they proceeded to hide it twice more in the first paragraph to the foreword to the first edition, where they said we have more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition, and that it's the purpose of this book to show others what we have done to recover. not to enlighten them philosophically so they could be moved to another level of awareness and therefore be well, but show them what we've done. And that book's full of this. It's talking about action. It's talking about what we do. It doesn't go in the record book. I was in the asylum one time. Y'all learned tonight I was in the asylum 18 times in 2.5 years. And I was in the asylum. Some fellow told me, he said, "Don, they don't put you in the asylum for being crazy." And I said, "Well, they put me in here for being crazy." And he said, "No, they didn't. They put you in here for acting crazy." And he said, "They don't let you out of the asylum for being sane either. They let you out of the asylum for acting sane." And by that time, I'd gotten out of 4 or 5 asylums knowing I was as mad as a hatter when they let me out by acting half sane. So I got to think about it, and that's true. And when you read this book, when this book's talking about sanity and insanity, it's not talking about a state of mind or emotion. It's talking about actions. And for me today, I now understand that being crazy, as uncomfortable as it is harmless. It's acting crazy that'll kill me. So, and on the other hand, feeling so spiritually centered that I'm just great, if I'm still continually taking actions that are not in my own best interest and the best interest of those around me, I don't care how sane I feel, I'm crazy as the devil. So I need to, that works for me, to judge where I am by how I'm doing. You know, and at home, several of us try to remind the other of this. Did you ever notice that every day, all day, we ask one another, "How you doing?" and immediately answer with how we're feeling. Now, in Louisville, and some of us around the fellowship have got the point where if somebody does that, we say, "Wait a minute, if I want to know how you're feeling, Don, I'll ask you about that. I want to know how you're doing." And it makes so much difference. But anyway, the reason Cherry talked about recovered rather than recovering was he knew who he was talking to. He knew that if I could latch on to being a poor little old sick recovering alcoholic that never did get okay, mired down forever in a never-ending process of just trying to struggle and get along in this alien world with all these earth people, he knew who he was dealing with. That 15 or 20 years dry, I'd be sitting around a clubhouse somewhere playing cards and saying, "Them earth people out there don't understand me. I can't get out there and work. I'm liable to get drunk, you know." Cherry wanted me to understand that if I've done these first 9 steps, which are the entire program of recovery, the way the book says do them, and then I'm living every day of, thank you so much, living every day of my life on 10, 11, and 12 the way the book says do it, then I ought to be at least as well equipped to deal with life on life's terms as a person who never had alcoholism. He didn't want me living my life as a cripple. He didn't want me grabbing hold of that excuse not to get out here and live in the world. I was also told, and I found it to be true in my life, that the steps are the prescription for alcoholism. And what I mean by that is simple. If I've got an infection that's going to kill me, but it's not treated, I don't need to understand all the ins and outs of my infection. I don't even need to believe that that silly infection is making all these terrible things wrong with magnificent me. I don't need to understand one single thing about how penicillin works in the human body. I don't even need to believe that that little bottle of pills can take care of all these terrible things wrong with me. And here's the kicker. I don't even really need to want to take the pills. Whether I want to take the pills or not is irrelevant. If I've got the infection and I take the pills as directed, I'll get just fine, thank you. And I was taught, and it's proved to be true for me, that these steps are the prescription for my alcoholism. They're not here for me to understand. They're not here for me to argue about. They're not here for me to memorize or quote. They are simply, this book's not a philosophy book. There's nothing in here I learned that'll keep me sober for a heartbeat. In fact, I was finally able to hear them as I was getting sober when they said, "Don, this book is not the solution to your alcoholism." And I said, "Wait a minute. You've been telling me for 2.5 years that this book is the solution to my alcoholism, And they said, no, we haven't. We've been telling you that the action described in this book is the solution to your alcoholism. So if I do these steps, whether I want to, whether I understand it, whether I believe it'll work or not, I find that it is the prescription for my alcoholism, and it works on my alcoholism just as well as that penicillin works on my infection. And they are, by the way, they're not called the steps accidentally. You know, they could have been called the 12 tenets or the 12 propositions or the 12 loads of things. But they're called steps because in the conventional staircase, step two actually must have step one because step two rests on step one. The first step is the base for step two. And it doesn't make any sense to have a staircase with first step, a third step, and a 12th step and nothing in between. And also, Cherry said if we weren't supposed to do them in order, they wouldn't have been numbered. A story that they used to tell around the program that I love points that out. It's about an alcoholic that had a flat tire out on an old dark country road. And alcoholic didn't have a jack. So the alcoholic says, what am I going to do? And looks way off in the distance, sees a little pinpoint of light. So the alcoholic starts walking toward the light. And the committee goes to work in the alcoholic's head. You know, what if that's not even a house up there and I walk all that far? What if it's a house and nobody's home? What if it's a house and it's somebody's home but they won't answer the door? What if they answer the door and they don't have a jack? What if they answer the door and they got a jack and won't let me borrow it? What if they answer the door, they got a jack, I borrow it, and I walk all the way back to my car and the jack won't fit? About that time, the alcoholic had knocked on the door. An old farmer opened the door and said, can I help you? The alcoholic said, I didn't want to borrow your damn jack anyway. So that's what's happened. And so many times, you know, you'll be sponsoring somebody, and they'll be coming up on the fourth step, and they'll say, man, I can't make amends to all those people. Well, my God, they may not live to get to step nine. In fact, some of the steps have got parts to them, you know, like you got 1A and 1B, powerless over alcohol and life unmanageable. You got 8A and 8B, made a list of everybody we harmed. A, B, became willing to make amends to them all. So I believe we don't need to be looking ahead. I believe we need to come like a little child, like a child following the dots on one of those pictures where the child doesn't know what the picture's going to be. But if the child follows the dots as directed, the picture will emerge. And that's the way the steps have worked for me. By the way, my Cherry did not like for me to talk about my program. Every time I made that slip of the tongue, he would say, wait a minute, partner, your program got you here. Just like my program got me here. There's not your program and my program, there's the program, and it's numbered 1 through 12. So people may approach it a little differently, but it's still the same program, numbered 1 through 12. 1 and 2, of course, require conclusions, and because I'm supposed to be talking about 4, 5, 6, and 7 mainly, I'm not gonna spend much time on 1 and 2 and 3. I'll tell you that my admission that I was an alcoholic intellectually, as far as I'm concerned, didn't have a thing to do with step 1. Because I had made that admission by the time I was 15 or 16 years old. The mistake I was making, and I was partly ashamed of that, and I was partly proud of it. You know, I knew about folks like Hank Williams and Ernest Hemingway and Winston Churchill and Alexander the Great, and I just knew that we were brothers, you know, under the skin with these oceans of compassion and creativity inside us, you know, and I knew it'd be inconvenient, kind of like having a bad arm or a bad leg or something, and I knew I'd die a number of years earlier, but my God, at that point, who wants to live to be 30 or 35 years old and so old you're no good to yourself or anybody else? You know, it seems much more attractive to live fast, love hard, die young, and leave a beautiful memory. And then when I got into one for what the conclusions really are in steps 1 and 2, I realized it didn't have anything to do with that intellectual conclusion because, see, the mistake I was making was that I thought I could live with alcoholism. I thought I could outrun it, bribe it, outsmart it, somehow live with it with just some inconvenience. But step 1's an absolutely hopeless human dilemma. I'm powerless over alcohol, meaning that I've got a physical allergy that once I put it in my body, there's no predicting what's going to happen. I set into motion a series of physical events inside my body that, unless they're interrupted from outside, will result in my mad dog death when I put that first alcohol in my body and trigger that physical allergy to alcohol. Bad part is I've got a mental obsession, which means that unless something's fixed inside me that I absolutely cannot fix and it's beyond any human power on earth to fix, I will pick up the first drink. Without that being fixed inside me, that thing that I cannot fix, I will wind up at some point being as powerless over that first drink as I am over the second one or the 22nd one. That's getting pretty bad. If I pick it up, I'm going to die a mad dog death, and I'm going to pick it up unless something that is beyond human control is fixed inside me. 1B, life had become unmanageable. By the time I got around here, my life was a god-awful mess, and I had zero denial about it, none. And I knew that I had managed about as terribly as a human being could manage. And I thought I'd done step 1B when I reached those conclusions. Hadn't even started. If my problem is my life's a mess because I've managed terribly, I don't need some sort of metaphysical higher power out here in step 2. I don't need to go to these silly little group therapy sessions with you guys in these meetings. I just need to grab the bull by the horns and put my shoulder to the wheel and manage that sucker better. But that's not what step says. It says it's unmanageable. It's like a car being undrivable. If my car's undrivable, I can go to every driving school in the country and get the greatest driving skills on earth, and I haven't touched the problem because it's undrivable. So what 1B really is that, yeah, my life's a mess. It's a mess because of what's wrong with me that I couldn't even have prevented, much less on my own do anything about fixing up. And when I reach those conclusions, I don't have anywhere to go but step 2. I don't care how repugnant it is to me, I got to go to step 2. The conclusions in step 2 that somewhere out there there's a power greater than me that's got the power to clean up that mess I made in step 1 and take care of that deadly dilemma I've got that if I drink, I'm going to die and I'm going to drink. Just kind of, as an oddity, I don't know that it means anything. Step 2 doesn't require any conclusion that power's got the slightest interest in messing with doing that. Because it said could, not would. And, of course, there's that left-handed conclusion. If I've restored to sanity, I've got to have been insane. Cherry taught me step 3 is the first action step. I thought step 3 was some sort of great big wallowing process, sort of like a Cecil B. DeMille movie of God and me going in a big marbled hall and rolling out the entire tapestry of my life, you know, future and past, and God and me walking up down. I think I secretly thought I'd make some suggestions, and God say, gee, I never thought of that, Don. Yeah, we'll do it that way. And then we'd get God's will mapped out. And I could go on true cruise control from now on because I'd know God's will. And, man, I could make policy where I always do this and I always do that and I never do this. I always want to do it. It's never that way. Step 3 doesn't turn a thing over to God. It's merely a decision to start on that path. And they explained to me that it's an action step. I've either gone in a room with an understanding person, said the third step prayer, and meant for that to be the moment when I started trying to do it God's way instead of mine. And what the commitment is simple. The commitment is that I'm going to do the rest of the steps, and I'm going to try to do the next right thing instead of what I want to do. And I've learned that if I'll do that, stumble along that way, I don't have to worry about trying to figure out what my life and will is supposed to be, because God will make my life and will what God wants it to be. As I was leaving the room after having done my third step with Cherry, he called me at the door and said, by the way, Don, not all the promises in this book are positive promises. And he had already let me know, you know, what we read at a meeting and call the promises, the eighth and ninth step promises, again, not trying to be controversial. If I'm at a meeting, somebody says, Don, will you read the promises? I'll get up the podium and I'll say, my name's Don, I'm now a colleague, here are the promises. And I'll read them. I won't give them a lecture on what isn't in the promises. But nobody ever intended for those to be the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous. Apparently somebody counted them one time and decided you could argue there are 12 of them. You can also argue there are 13 of them, or you can argue there are 11 of them. But the important thing is they are by no means all the promises in the book. They're the third step promises, fifth step promises, tenth step promises, 11th step promises. They're promises all through this book, and some of them are so beautiful. The third step promises says, when we took this position, all sorts of remarkable things happened. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him, performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, those are some nice promises, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Those are pretty strong promises. You don't get much stronger than losing your fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter, and being reborn. But what Cherry said as I was walking out the door, he said, you know, not all the promises are positive. He said, be aware, Don, that this third step you've just done, the book promises us, won't amount to a hill of beans unless you follow it at once with a fourth step. And that's exactly what the book says. Bottom 63 and page 64 says, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless it once followed by a strenuous effort to face, in other words, the fourth step. What Cherry said that meant was that if I had not done my fourth step and my third step evaporated on me, that it wouldn't be necessary to call him and whine about it until I was willing to start on the fourth step, because the book promises me that the third step will have little permanent effect unless followed at once. And he also pointed this out. He said, Don, if that book had meant that the third step wouldn't have much effect unless it was followed by a fourth step when your group thought you were ready to do it, that's what the book would have said. If it had meant it'll have little permanent effect unless followed by a fourth step when you feel like you can do it without getting drunk, that's what it would have said. Said, but it didn't say any of those things. It said the third step won't have much effect at all unless you at once start in on the fourth step. Now, by that time, I had become as willing as only the dying can be to grasp hold of a reed that turns out to be the hand of God. So sure enough, at once, about 8 months later, I started the fourth step. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Rather than getting into this, let's go ahead and take about a 10-minute break and come back at 11, and then we'll do another hour, and that'll take us through 4, 5, 6, and 7. Is that okay? Thank y'all.